Bustamante is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Join us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Host Ray Hill, legal analyst Rob Professor Dennis Longmire, and reporting from a vigil in Odessa, Texas, Father Mark Miller, begins. Most don't.
And good evening, this is Ray Hill. You're listening to Execution Watch on executionwatch.org and on radio station KPFT, Houston HD2 channel. This is scheduling the execution of Samuel, charged in 1998, fatal stabbing of 27-year-old Richmond, Texas. This is a Fort Bend County case. And Bustamante's attorney requested arguing that he received inadequate representation of his state-appointed appellate attorney who had failed to conduct investigation in his client's background and missed critical filing deadlines. You can find the back page of thisex.org. It is the one that comes up on the page whenever you come to it, and it will be the top one on. Want the producer Elizabeth get in contact with the death chamber vigil in Huntsville, and I'm on the phone, and we're going to be talking to him as soon as she pushes the right buttons. Dennis, are you there? Dennis, are you on? Are you there?
Well, there are about 16 of us on the corner. All of the witnesses have gone into the building, and so the execution is going forward as planned. There is a group of people here from Bearcats for Life, which is a student pro-life organization with the Sam Houston State University.
Uh-huh.
And one of the members says that she will happily pass.
Okay, please.
I'm doing as well as you can be while you're watching someone.
Is this your first vigil?
Yes, actually, it's the first time we do them week to come, so it's a pretty moving experience, I guess.
And you're a student there, you're a freshman at education, okay?
Yes.
And are you a member of the?
Yep, I sure am.
Do they have meetings? Do y'all have meetings?
Oh yes, we usually have meetings about once a month to group out there and just bring awareness to the many issues, to natural death, and just like the different hate people on, what this really is, like criminal punishment or capital punishment, different abortions, different things like that. Like, what is life?
Is Huntsville your home?
No, I'm here now while I'm going to school. So most of us aren't from Huntsville.
So you're from Montgomery, which isn't too far away.
Yeah, it's only about probably like 45 minutes, maybe.
Yeah.
So it's not too far. I can go home regularly.
Well, thank you, and tell Dennis we'll be back in touch with him when he has something else to report. Okay. Dennis?
Hey.
Dennis?
Hey. There are two other people here from Brownsville who have come to visit, and I'm wondering if you want to speak to one of them.
Sure, if you've got some there and they're handy.
Sure. One second here. Ray
Hill. Hello, Ray. My name is Elmita Velez.
Yes, Ms. Sivella.
Here, Marisol Velez as well. We're from Brownsville, Texas.
It's a long way from Brownsville, Texas.
Yes, it is. Out here, we were visiting an inmate in the death row as well.
Uh-huh.
And we're joining...
Well, not long ago, we had someone from participating in a vigil down there. Are you aware of those?
We have Mr. Kraus, yeah. Being his wife. I joined them a couple of times out over there in Brownsville. Okay. And we have a little show in Brownsville as well.
And it is your son that is on death row?
No.
Would you be sure and give your brother Ray Hill's warmest regards?
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. And so we're going to... Dennis.
Yes.
When you... Okay?
I will. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Uh-huh. Professor of criminal Houston University in Huntsville. We are back in the studio now, and we have two lawyers, actually. We have a lawyer that has been involved in the case, Mr. James Writing. And James, step up to the mic, this case.
what didn't happen at trial and reasons. It turns out that Samuel Bustamante suffers from mild mental retardation, and that is a defense against the death penalty in state habeas proceedings, and it was not raised. So what is going to happen today is it violates Atkins versus Question, cruel and unusual punishment to enforce the death penalty against someone like Sam Bustamante. But
hi, I'm Robert Rosenberg. What is the Atkins case about?
Where the Supreme Court determined cruel and unusual punishment to inflict the death penalty on people that suffer from mental retardation. That is, people that have an IQ of around 7 adaptive deficits. And they prohibited it. Sam, we have 3 experts that have Mr. Bustamante, and they're in agreement that he fits the criteria and should not be executed.
So have the courts ever actually considered the Atkins?
You got to get work of the microphone.
The case, or you had mentioned that his attorneys had failed to raise his attorneys were and the proceedings that transpired prior to today?
Sure. The attorney at trial was a man named Sidney Crowley. Proceedings was a man named Stephen Rocket Rosen. Have the courts considered the evidence? I would say they've done so in a false or even fake way. They considered it unmeet. In order for them to even reach the claim, we had to prove, because of the procedural posture, as it were, that we were in, that so retarded, so to speak, that no reasonable jury would ever find, no reasonable jury would ever have a question about it. We had to prove that by clear and convincing evidence, just on the paper, without a hearing, without any due process. And of course, you'll naturally lose justice in place, that they've at least have looked at your pleadings, and even if they threw them out the window, it appears that you've been given some modicum or some bit of justice in the case.
These issues were not raised in the trial.
Right.
You had to wait, not in the direct appeal, but the habeas appeal.
Correct. The state habeas attorney should have introduced this evidence. They should have raised this claim. After all, Atkins was decided in 2000, and Bustamante's direct appeal wasn't decided until 2003. Case law that applied directly to Mr. Bustamante, and he didn't use it.
Is there anything about the Bustamante case that particularly highlights some of this? And how they're conducted in Texas, in particular, appointment of counsel, the state courts consider them, and then the process to defer to the state court. For instance, as a habeas attorney, in state court, there's never an opportunity of any kind of evidentiary hearing where you can challenge the state's witnesses, prepares the findings of fact. The judge signs the findings of fact, post findings, and then those go to the Court of Criminal Appeal. And then they go to the federal court, where typically they're accepted and deferred to as though they're action of the facts. Is that your experience, a different experience in this case, or any other experience, any other cases?
Let's stick with Sam's case, since he's unfortunately at this, you know, maelstrom not only for Sam, but and in Sam's case, the problem. Is not just with Texas, on federal law and the way that it's been interpreted by the courts, including our Supreme Court, state of the law. Why they could not say in a case like Sam's that, look, you get a hearing. In my belief, principles of federalism or any of the other abstractions that they use to justify killing people without a fair hearing, where the problem lies, with their strict interpretation of federal law. Judge Dennis, in a recent case, a good judge on the Fifth Circuit, you need to provide procedural due process to people bringing Atkins claims and make sure that you have due process here than property right, for example, doing it, and the federal courts are not making them give people basic rights. You can show, as they call it, of mental retardation. Those people are dependent on their attorneys. Bring these issues to light. It seems obvious to anyone, I would think. Executing someone who's mentally retarded is cruel and unusual punishment it isn't any less so, failed to bring up an Atkins claim. Clearly, that makes it even worse. I believe the federal courts haven't.
You actually know Sam.
Yes.
Sam understand what's happening?
This is one of the problems. He suffers from mild mental retardation. That doesn't mean he's completely incompetent. That doesn't mean that he's a blubbering idiot. It's to think you have to show guidance with proper education. If his problems had been recognized, he likely would have been, as he has been in many aspects of his life, likable, recognized, either outside the court system or inside it. That is why Rafael Alvarado is dead. And that is why, because of these misconceptions of what mild retardation is.
In your tone of voice, I find that this is not really an unusual.
It's not. I have more than one client in his situation, unfortunately, and it's going to be a fight in each case where the claim wasn't raised in state habeas, and now you have to jump through procedural hoops that look like they're giving some semblance of justice.
That's a facade.
A facade.
Don't you find this frustrating work?
It is frustrating work. Fortunately, we've had some success, as hard as it is an arena. And one of the reasons we've had success is because good attorneys, such as the folks at the
Tech. What cases are going to be successful and what are not, or is this all a crapshoot?
It is not. What cases are going to, if you do some investigation? So could the state habeas attorneys, but they don't do the.
Would that not require funds?
It does require funds, and it requires you. The state habeas attorneys do have an uphill climb, and just to the attorneys, like you're suggesting. It is the system, the way things are set up. It's made to make sure that convictions are upheld, even if they violate the Constitution.
Do you see any changes that are actually going to take place when they institute the office where they're going to have a permit to handle these cases?
Yes, I know exactly what you're referring to. The question is, are they going to have staff or are they going to have an understaff? Mm-hmm. That's to be how long these people is, you know, what type of job security do these people have? Sure, if you have an org that can, will have some his and act as a team like a law firm, it will be a great help. But if they just give them half of the cup, they're going to be destined to fail. They're going to find their budget cuts, and it will be a disservice.
I don't know if you were around in about 88 or 89 when they set up the Texas Resource Center at UT, where they were going to fund the University of Texas and then recruit private lawyers to work at that time for free on habeas cases. Were you involved at that point?
Do you know of attempts to recruit private lawyers to do habeas? A powwow of federal and state judges down at the federal court there, hat in their hand, begging the firms to please take cases pro bono. It was just a flat-out admission. It doesn't fund habeas work adequately. That's all it could be considered.
The question offered as to why they don't want to fund it and why they want
a meeting that was designed to be critical of anything. It was mostly patting on the back, and then folks that they hoped had bags of money that they would at least let a few of their junior associates tell what it was about.
Did any of them seem really interested?
I do not think so many are interested, because right now big law firms are facing economic problems of their own, and they do not want to be sucked into a black hole that a habeas can turn out to be.
At what point did you get involved in this case?
We were appointed by facsimile.
Federal habeas.
So it was federal habeas in 2004, and Judge Hughes is a case, we took it.
And this has been a burden on the firm.
Has been a burden on the firm. For the past round of federal habeas cases that were brought, raised by the state, one claim. And since then, it's been volunteer work by us, SAM supporters, and I should say, with extraordinary talented and clinicians in psychology, Diane Mosnick, Dr. Greenspan, and Bat for Sam.
But the playing field was already defined by the original trial and the state direct appeal and habeas appeal. That,
in district
that put fences around where
right,
you could go.
Right, in district stuck nothing. So
how does the case get traction at the level that any hope at that point? If you don't have something back there, if you don't have some gravel back there in the trial and in the direct, how do you get traction at the federal habeas level?
Is because the state decisions are awful, often part of the reason they're abominable is that the bar is set so low by federal law. All they have to do is in some sense reasonable, and they think, and that's all there is to it. And so the work is sloppy, and you can, that they didn't even meet this low threshold, and that we've managed to do that in a couple of cases. Robert Frost,
though, on which judge in federal court you may end up with, and that some are never going to grant a habeas, including, for instance, in the Frada Guidry Prytash situation. In Frada's case, it was Judge Harmon, wasn't it?
Judge Harmon, she did grant.
She did, but as you read the opinion, you could almost feel the pain that was in her. She transcribed it. Or see the sickened look on her face to have to actually grant a habeas. Harmon, but years ago she did tell us in a case that she was not going to grant, even said, I'm not granting relief, you'll have to try at the Fifth Circuit. I haven't looked at the pleadings yet. Eek.
I think the federal judges are, if you can say it in the same sentence, they may be conservative, but they try to be fair. Slogan, he was a cruel man, but fair. But you do get judges in your work, unlike, I'm sorry to say, in an honest shake. It may be that the federal judges, and you do, but they are not going to intentionally, as that is my experience, try to sink a case out of motives in what is legally right. Now, what their conception of what the law is and how it should be interpreted, but I don't see in the federal system or in the courts something nefarious like I'm going to sink these
predisposition and a certain set of facts, which I think in Bustamante's case, in reading about it, it was a particularly brutal crime, and that the man and they went back for him or something, and years has been a certain set of facts that are particularly brutal, or in the case of a child, because of the whole prejudice issue, which I guess we don't really have time to delve into very deeply today, the defendant was prejudiced with most of these errors. The federal judges, as fair as they may want to be, can easily say, whatever the errors were, whatever the harm was, in this particular case, there was no prejudice.
Well, let's
they want
just
to use
getting
it.
Back to Mr. Bustamante's case.
Sure.
It's a tremendous error at trial. His brother's confession was ruled inadmissible. It just lays out it would have been sufficient to send Mr. Bustamante. This evidence, but it did somehow. We don't know. We still don't know how.
Exactly.
This confession gets back into the jury room, and the jurors read it. They're on the record. Saying. Yes, the foreman of the jury read the whole thing out loud to everybody. How did the Texas court...
This was not admitted evidence.
Excluded.
If I'm not mistaken, they had about 3 hours between the time it was read to them and the time that the judge started looking into it to discuss it, including having lunch over it. And
okay. The point is this. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals actually ruled, if you can believe it, that receive that confession. Now, I think a federal district court
discussion is getting emotional and understands between James writing and Robert Rosenberg, and they're both attorneys. They both have practices and they have different cases, but you can hear in their voices of trying to defend someone on death row, the lights on the telephone, when the rules seem to slip under the rug, whether it's the nature of the case or the participants of the case or some kind of special case. Reaching over to bring Dennis Longmire. Dennis?
Yes, Ray.
Have you something to report?
Well, yes. All of the witnesses have come out of the building, left concluded. Gloria is speak with you. She is within seconds of me, so I'm going to give her the phone and let her talk with you.
Okay. I appreciate that, Dennis. Let me explain to the audience.
Hi, Ray.
Hello, Gloria. Let me explain to the audience that we're making a transition from the frustration of who are concerned about the quality of the trial, the quality of the state appeals facing the attorneys at the point of a regular witness of what goes in Huntsville, Ms. Gloria Ruback. Take it away, Gloria.
Well, I just witnessed the execution. It's amazing, damn easy they can make murder. Sam, peaceful. He had his hair combed. He was shaved. He looked very healthy young man. And then they killed him, and now he's dead. So it just smelt what this state can do. I'm furious. His aunt, who he calls mom, and we're in there watching broken into a million pieces. The torment through when somebody's executed, it's the same. Are you there, Ray?
Gloria, keep your hands off the buttons.
Oh, okay, I'm touching.
This is not your first execution to observe.
No, there's a partition and you can't talk. First execution, it was in 1993, and I was standing. Now, as close as Dennis and I are standing right now, so they killed him. Now they've got plexiglass, and there's a microphone for the person being murdered to speak into, but he can't hear anything that we say. So it's quite a different situation. There weren't any of the victims curtained off then, had they have been here. But is laying there, getting ready to be executed, you can't even talk to them. But that's how they do it.
Gloria, give our regrets and respect to the family that you see there. Thank you very much for your deep commitment and vigilance.
Okay, and thanks to you and Elizabeth and everybody for keeping the Execution Watch show going.
Thank you, ma'am. She's a friend of not only Execution Watch, she's a frequent voice on here. Normally this time, because she knew Sam Bustamante, she would end. Sam Bustamante is dead. The state of Texas has executed him as of about 10 minutes ago. It takes about 5 minutes for the witnesses to get out, and you heard the report with their attorneys. And I'm simply going to throw a simple question first to Mr. Riding. Mr. Riding?
Well, what happened is utterly senseless. The family members that went to be with Sam, remarkable women, both Joanna, who have cared for Sam. Important to know is that when Sam was Joanna, he person. It was when he was tormented, when he was beaten by other members of, unfortunately, by parents and by peers at school who didn't understand his limitations. That he became frustrated and violent. In prison, he was a mob, and he would have been a gentle man, a kind days, if they hadn't killed him. So we're not protected from anything.
Robert, get close to the microphone.
At the trial during the punishment phase, was any of the background presented and...
Yes.
A coherent way?
Yes, it was. It was. His family members had to take the stand very bravely. Others came forward. Sam's brother came forward and had to disclose, as painful as it was, what happened to Sam during his youth.
Yes, I am.
All right. Father Miller, tell me.
Okay, well, I'm in Odessa, Texas. I am part of the Odessa chapter against the death penalty, and each evening when there is an execution, Boulevard, which is in front of our church, and for a half an hour just holding signs, you know, asking to stop the death penalty and a few other signs that has other things on, like killing the killers does not teach people, you know, that kind of thing. And then we go as well as for the a person responsible for the crime and his or her family.
Vigilance did you have this evening?
We had, let's see, people standing outside them that came inside then for the prayer.
Father, I don't know if Elizabeth told you, but Mr. Bustamante is now dead.
Because I know it's after 6.
Yeah. The executed by 6:20 or 6:25.
Yeah, right.
And we've been having a discussion here in the do habeas appeals. Very difficult work for lawyers, and I'm fixing to get deeper into that conversation. But I want to thank you and ask you to vigilance there in Odessa.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Mark Miller in Odessa. He is with St. Joseph's Catholic Church, and they do a, I believe, this is our first time to visit Odessa, but we have been around the state. If you're out there listening to Execution Watch, either via executionwatch.org or by KPFT HD2 alone, if you were concerned about this activity. Robert, I'm going to ask you a simple question. James is going to go away, and we appreciate your services to the program. An attorney actually in the neighborhood, to professionally remove yourself from the emotion of this incident?
No. Other than maybe the at least I don't take it, you know, I develop a relationship. I mean, Franklin Alec, who was and visited him many times, James got to, you go through a long, long process. Oftentimes you are, you know, part of my job is if, once, you know, it becomes clear there's going to be no relief, is the client's family adjust to the finality of that person's life, and which I think in Franklin's case happened, you know, but I like it is. If you, I mean, you take it home. You can't not take it home. When you go out to, I mean, they say, what kind of work do you do? And you say, well, I represent people on death row. They either go, whoa, that must be depressing, or how could you? Those are despicable people, or that's great that you do that. Somebody needs to.
It's my, one of our founding fathers two British soldiers in, because they have a responsibility of dealing with difficult situations as an attorney.
Or unsettling about this business with the Capital Defender's Office is they tried to, and that's how I got into death penalty work, is because the Fifth Circuit and the state judges all made a plea to big firm lawyers to take on these cases for free. And
on an assembly line process.
Well, you can't do it on an assembly line process when it takes, according to them, per case on average.
Yeah.
At that time, there was no money. He was able to prevail on psychiatrists and psychologists and people like that, and that's what you do in our line of work.
Is you beg.
You beg for this. Well, if you know, my view is or Oklahoma, whoever has the death penalty, if they want to have the death penalty, they need to act straightforward way. I'm opposed generally to the death penalty. I think that everybody, or for the most part, everybody on the paths, but well, have sad stories to tell.
Some of these cases are not.
There are no pretty ones.
There are no pretty ones, but there is a
variety, but there's also a certain sameness. And the sameness is that virtually everyone on death row tortured past to that they lived through that got them to the point where they are throw. And nobody in the system, be it children's welfare, the schools, or wherever it was, nobody didn't know that that kid was being raised in a way that they were either when they were kids or young, or become violent themselves and end up in prison or on death row.
Before this show was done, Elizabeth and I were tasked with substituting for KPFT's Eats, and we discussed the Bustamante case.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a pretty case.
No,
Mr. Bustamante went hunting.
Shopping,
and he went looking for undocumented people, and he had two accomplices. One of them, God, is awaiting his turn on death row. And they wound up taking somebody out and killing him in a not pretty way. And it was a horrible case. And the people, the victim in this case, was extremely vulnerable and as a collateral by the day, considering what's going on in Arizona.
Well, and this is from his family there, and why... he probably didn't have the, you know, a family like, you know, James represents Robert Frada and I represent Howard Guidry, and they were involved in the same case. The death of Frada family, her parents have made it their life's mission, my understanding, to make certain that everybody is executed. Well, case.
Did not have an advocate. Didn't need one, apparently.
No. But it was a particularly, I only know from reading it, and it sounded very horrific and brutal. I believe his name is Mr. Alvarado.
He died all alone.
Out in the middle of nowhere, you know, by the side. You know, I think it also probably had to do with the timing of when it happened and the focus on crime. I mean, I believe that, you know, we saw a lot of prosecutions of capital murder of gang members mid-90s,
sure,
when everybody was worried about gangs, and all of a sudden you started seeing a lot of Asian kids on death row.
Sure.
When the Asian trying to send a message, we're going to be tough on gangs, because everybody... Now you don't hear so much about gangs, and it's back to the normal, I don't want to say normal, less...
Following a pattern that Texas follows.
Right. I doubt that the death penalty had anything to do with the cutback on gang members committing capital murder.
It seems to me that if we're going to try to send a message to somebody that we're serious about, that message is the one that is not watching television tonight.
It's probably true. On the paper about a drug kingpin who's been extradited from Mexico, who's 65 years old, and according to the U.S. attorney here. That's first of all, I'm thinking like, well, you
do
know,
your arithmetic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure the government had to.
Those are probably not an easy 65 years.
Well, he did make it to 65, so my guess is he was a kingpin. He lived in kind of luxury. But, you know, there's this with James, although I don't really know him, but I do believe involved in the criminal justice system from top to bottom.
But I think you intimated that there was some kind of judge roulette.
There is
you
a judge
the
roulette.
Wheel, and you wind up with what you get.
You know, in the Frada case where Judge Harmon reversed that drunk and had to reverse the conviction because in the Guidry case that the evidence used to convict him was illegal. So she didn't have much choice.
She was not a happy camper.
You could tell she wasn't happy. Have had anything to do with her? You know, she would. I don't know. You know how she was behaving. I can't
say. Be careful.
But it seems as though there are many federal judges in the Fifth Circuit who have won capital habeas reversal in them, and then there is a handful of others, a very small handful, that take their job more seriously and do what they're supposed to do.
If this society were to grow up, the killing part, would it help the rest?
It. Because most of our criminal law that is developed through case law, or a good portion of it, and the only reason it happened, they have to, under the law, they have to appoint attorneys to represent these people. If you're sentenced to life without parole, you're not entitled to a habeas. So if you're which is a death sentence, and if your family can't find some schmo like me or James who'll step up and do it, which is in all likelihood the kind of family that's going to prison for life without parole. And so while we may be appalled by it, the fact of the matter is that law is developed through the right to effective assistance of counsel, which was one of the cases by state habeas of Mr. Bustamante. Was it at the Bustamante trial, there was the confession of the brother that had been ruled inadmissible, or the statement where Sam Bustamante supposedly confessed to his brother about the horrible facts of the crime. Well, somehow or other, the written statement of Sam's exhibit number as another exhibit, and they spent 3 hours talking about it. And so Rocket Rosen, who was the habeas attorney, filed an ineffective, which was the only claim in habeas, that Sid Crowley was ineffective because he did not read through the, he did not look through the exhibits before they were given to the jury.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a fairly basic task that a lawyer, a fundamental thing. And somehow or other, no authority was bothered by that. Sid Crowley is still, you know, appointed to cases. Rocket Rosen, who apparently missed the fact that Mr. Bustamante was mentally retarded to the level that under the law he should not be executed, missed that. Well, Rocket Rosen, both Sid Crowley and Rocket Rosen, they're generally ineffective attorneys, miss filing deadlines, and they don't raise any claims. Yet, they get appointed over and over again. They make the prosecutor's work easy. Don't have to work very hard. And there is a certain, and there's a great deal of dishonesty to it. Who is on the Court of Criminal Appeals in a case, special issues the jury must answer to determine whether or not somebody's going to get the death being evidence, such as a person's background or whether they're mentally retarded, things like that. In a case that went to the Supreme Court 3 times before Texas,
yes,
chastised criminal appeals and said that they dishonestly use what's called the procedural, because what happened was in that case, the Smith case, the Court of Criminal Appeals said, well, he's procedurally barred from bringing this up because he didn't bring it up earlier. But Smith, Judge Holcomb said that many claims that are Montes is one of them, are procedurally barred. And the court, if they had tried to get a psychologist or to test Sam, the state would have opposed that.
Mm-hmm.
And if they got him tested, argued that there should be no hearing on a psychologist or education person, whoever, to say
that he was a rocket scientist.
He's fine. And then whatever this, and there are no procedures that are systematically that a lawyer can rely upon to present the case. That's one of the basic problems in Arizona and California. Routinely have evidentiary hearings. They routinely have in Florida, they have discovery proceedings before the trial, where a defense lawyer can take the deposition of any of the state's witnesses. Well, here, if you want to see documents, you can go down to the DA's office. May have changed the proceedings, copies of the documents. But historically, you could take notes. You couldn't get a photocopy.
You could get a copy.
Well, how in the world do you know if that's the same piece of the trial as the one you saw 6 months ago?
Sure.
And let's not be foolish to think that it doesn't change sometimes.
Yeah, I've watched, not in capital cases, but make detailed written later documents.
But even then, you don't have anything where you can say, well, here's what it looked last week, and this is, why does it look this way this week? Or what happened to that document? You know, last week when we talked about, I was a little overwhelming evidence against the guy. Well, they had a DNA test and two confessions that he gave. But they didn't have the gun that the FBI people came in and said, this was the gun.
Right.
Well, and then after he's on death row, they said, well, to me,
that
sort of raised and was actually a good confession. Father, who was in the military and not present, and maybe he wasn't the brightest guy in the room.
Yeah.
And we know that there are false confessions, and we know that there's bad DNA. It wasn't the gun.
It wasn't.
So what evidence did they have?
This conversation is between now Ray Hill and Robert Rosen. I'm just a guy on the radio. He is anguishing over the quality of the evidence in capital cases. My experience, I was with Winston Cochran, actually on the air, and I sat there and watched Winston Cochran melt down so that we couldn't do a radio show of the death of a client that he rented. And there was another attorney by the name of John from that I was on the radio with when his client died. And it can be a devastating experience. James did not leave here in very good condition. James writing did not leave here in very
good
condition.
No, he was very visibly upset.
He was I don't think we have to explain to the audience because they heard it.
But, you know, I mean, I invited him to come unbeknownst to Elizabeth and Ray. But
we don't tell Elizabeth.
Should invite all habeas lawyers to come because I do think that there's a certain benefit to actually being able to at least one time
have somebody
hear the story that you have been banging your head against the wall to get somebody to hear.
Capital Writs Office.
Yes.
Office of Capital Writs.
Offenberg. Mm-hmm. It has $1 million. How far is that going to go?
Because they're going to not pay anybody anything to do anything.
No, the Office of Capital Writs was established last summer. There is a search going on for a director, and the office itself is supposed to open with a director.
In radio, clock is God, and God tells me that we were able to do this because of the hard work of Elizabeth Stein. She is our executive producer. The technical wizardry that we would normally have from Otis McClay has been substituted for tonight by what's the young man's name?
Kierman.
And Kierman is in the other room flipping switches.
And Bobby and Afshar.
And we're winging it. I want to thank Robert Rosenberg for coming into it. I want to thank Gloria for her anguishing comments after the execution. And, of course, Dennis Longmire. We got to remember that we talked in where we went to?
Yes.
Odessa to Father Mark Miller. And my name is Ray Hill, and the music you heard at the beginning of the program